From the quest for the Holy Grail to the meaning of dreams, humankind has always had a thirst for unanswerable questions. And in the 1990s, billions of dollars were poured into this one. Which is the best SSRI? Welcome to the Carlett Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Your patient is a 35-year-old woman who has never taken an antidepressant and has been depressed for a year since moving to a new city. Which antidepressant should you start her on? David Oss's Psychopharmacology Algorithm Project took a stab at that question, and we covered that in our May issue. Dr. Oss's work generated a lot of questions, including this one, from Zach Feldman in Raleigh, North Carolina. Why was fluoxetine left off the list of first-line options for major depression?
The first-line options in Dr. Osser's algorithm were, in alphabetical order, bupropion, Wellbutrin, escitalopram, Lexapro, and sertraline, Zoloft. Unless there is an urgent need for ECT, in which case they recommend going straight there.
Who has an urgent need for ECT?
Well, psychotic depression and melancholic depression have the best response to ECT. So if the patient has one of those depressive subtypes and is acutely suicidal or gravely ill, like so depressed that they're not eating, or if they're pregnant because ECT is safer in pregnancy than psychotropics, then they would go straight to ECT.
So back to the fluoxetine question. Fluoxetine was the first SSRI released in the US, and it quickly became the standard bearer for depression. So why didn't it make the cut for first-line options? We reached out to Dr. Osser, and here's what he had to say in an email. Fluoxetine did not do as well as others in the two comparative efficacy network meta-analyses by Andrea Cipriani and colleagues, the latest being in 2018. In fact, it had one of the worst results compared with other SSRIs, which might be because it takes longer to work due to the long time it takes for the active metabolite, norfluoxetine, to reach steady state. And most of the studies reviewed were short-term, and there wouldn't be time for fluoxetine to reach its full effect. Also, it has more drug interactions than the preferred agents. Then Dr. Russell went on to share a story about practicing in the heyday of the SSRIs, the 1990s. The huge effect of marketing can't be better illustrated than by the market share of fluoxetine when it was competing with sertraline and paroxetine, when all three were brand products. Prozac was number one with market share no matter what the other products did. Everyone thought it was the most effective SSRI, so Lilly got away with charging almost twice as much for it than the others and would not cut the price with the pharmacy benefit manager companies. So these companies went nuts trying to get prescribers to prefer the others, even restricting access to Prozac in some cases. But Prozac was the first SSRI, and they were able to keep it positive in people's thinking with their ad campaigns. But when it became generic and cheap, and they stopped advertising it, it rapidly dropped below the others, and it seemed everyone became convinced it didn't work as well as the others or had more side effects. Only with these network matter analyses do we start to have some evidence on the question of what is best. Not perfect by any means, though.
There was a lot of misinformation about the SSRIs in the 1990s, and some of those myths still linger today. In this two-part episode, we're going to clear some of that smoke, and at the end of it, we'll find some solid ground to help you choose among the SSRIs. First, let's go back to those early days. Fluoxetine came out in 1987, but it was really December 29, 1987, so nobody really took it until 1988. America was just coming out of the Iran-Contra affair and stepping into an election year that would pit Michael Dukakis against the eventual winner, George H.W. Bush. Phantom of the Opera premiered on Broadway. The Surgeon General came down on nicotine, and Jimmy the Greek was fired from CBS for making racist comments about black athletes. And, based on the number one song of that year, people were looking at themselves in the mirror. And they were ready to make a change.
I'm gonna make a change for once in my life.
Wait a minute. Man in the Mirror was the number one song in America? But it wasn't big in Australia. It only charted at 39 and didn't do so well in Europe. And I've got to say, it's a very American song. Make that change. In other countries, we're not so into self-improvement in the way that Americans are. We didn't have Tony Robbins, Zig Ziglar, and Dale Carnegie prancing around the stage.
Yeah, Kelly, Sigmund Freud felt the same way. He was really turned off by the American optimism and felt that Americans, even back then, were always jumping on the latest fad of self-improvement to make everything about them better. And Prozac certainly caught on to that zeitgeist in the 1990s, particularly with Peter Kramer's coinage of the word cosmetic psychopharmacology in his best-selling 1993 book, Listening to Prozac. So after Prozac, sertraline was the next to come on in 1991, followed by paroxetine in 1992. That's when I started my career at the National Institutes of Mental Health, so I witnessed some of the outsized effect that these medications had on our field.
What was that like?
Back then, the SSRIs were a topic of constant conversation. Psychiatrists who not long ago spent their time trying to understand what motivated people and all the intricacies of the human mind were now just trying to scramble around to figure out which was the best SSRI. Demand for these medications was up, and reimbursement for psychotherapy was down. So much of what we did all day was try to help patients choose between Prozac, Zoloft, and Paxil. Doctors don't like to admit ignorance, but here they were forced to make this decision every hour without any good data to guide it. And into that knowledge gap stepped the industry, or more specifically, the speakers on their panels. I remember going to those talks in the 90s, and it made me sad. The audience was hungry for knowledge. Everyone was chattering about which SSRI worked the best. One doctor cornered me, asking me which one I preferred. "Well, they all come out the same in the studies," I said. "Ah, but no, I'm asking what you see with your own eyes. Which one do you get the best results with? Because with me, it's paroxetine." So there was this palpable hunger, but with it, an undercurrent of cynicism, because deep down, people knew that most of the answers they were being fed were served up by the pharmaceutical industry.
And Dr. Oss's sense was that Prozac won that marketing war. Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, hired Innobrand to market the drug. And here's Innobrand on how they came up with a name. The goal of their marketing campaign, in their words, was to intentionally distance the medication from everything typically associated with antidepressants. Strong chemicals, side effects, and mood swings. The easy and accessible language provided patients a platform to talk comfortably and openly about their condition.
And that's what they did. Patients were talking about it, doctors were talking about it. The SSRIs were seen as safe in overdose, and they seemed to lack any serious medical risks. As long as you didn't mind the sexual side effects, they were risk-free, and doctors started prescribing them far outside their FDA indications. Looking back, those were kind of blissfully naive times, and since then we've learned a lot more about their risks, from the suicidality risks that came out in 2003, osteopenia in postmenopausal women, cardiac arrhythmias from QTC prolongation, and there's even evidence that they increase the risk of diabetes, although not nearly to the extent that the atypical antipsychotics do. But in the 1990s, the main problem that the drug companies faced was how to distinguish their SSRI from the others. We'll continue on that note in part two of this episode, where we'll weed through those marketing claims to see how well they've held up over time.
And now to the word of the day, zimelidine.
The first SSRI was actually not Prozac. It was zimelidine, a serotonergic antidepressant derived from an antihistamine. And when it first came out, it had all the qualities that made fluoxetine famous: safe, effective, and well-tolerated. Zimelidine had its start in Germany in 1981 as the brand name Normud, kind of like a cross between normal and mud. Other European countries soon followed, but by 1983, reports of Guillain-Barré syndrome on the drug emerged, and it was withdrawn from the worldwide market.
So fluoxetine was the second SSRI to be released?
No, fluoxetine was actually the third. The second was fluvoxamine, Luvox, which came out in Switzerland in 1983. It didn't hit the American market until 1993, where it has only been approved for OCD, both in children and adults. But in other countries, it's approved for depression and social anxiety disorder. By the way, fluvoxamine is being repurposed right now. It's undergoing clinical trials in COVID-19, where it's thought that it might fight the cytokine storm that comes along with that illness. You can find the full articles online at thecarlattreport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You can get a year's subscription and CME credits with the promo code PODCAST that'll get you $30 off your first year.
And your support helps us stay free of pharmaceutical influence.